Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In Southern California, the 70,000 members of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union are in their sixth week of a strike against three of the nation's largest supermarket chains. To the workers, the issue is whether or not they'll earn wages and benefits they can live on. The supermarkets say that without givebacks, they can't compete with the 40 Walmart supercenters that are due to arrive in the area beginning this winter with aisles full of groceries. Shopping for bargains at Walmart is great, it seems, until you have to work there. As the world's biggest retailer and others mainline globalization and hyper-efficiency to the heart of the U.S. economy, there's a growing tension between those low prices and wages people can live on. Tonight on Point, Walmart, globalization, and the hidden cost of everyday low prices. Does your hunt for a bargain line up with a worker's hunt for a decent job? Can America have Walmart prices and middle-class wages? And if this is the future, where do you fit in? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Los Angeles are two of California's striking grocery store workers. Diane DeBoer works at the Ralph Supermarket, a Kroger-owned store in Marina del Rey. She started as a box person at Ralph's 25 years ago. Now she runs the grocery department on the night shift. Good evening and welcome, Diane DeBoer.
Hi, thank you.
Great to have you.
Thank you for having me.
You're quite welcome. And Ted Lubke works in the meat department at Vons, a Safeway company supermarket in West Los Angeles. Good evening and welcome, Ted Lubke.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Ted Lubke, why are you on strike?
There's a number of different reasons. Main reason is our benefits and pension plans. They want us to pay for our benefits, which I don't have a problem with, but they want to cut them by 50%, which is the problem.
So the supermarket owners are asking you to pay more than you have in the past for your benefits, and they're asking you to pay a lot more.
Right, but I don't even have a problem with that if they leave our benefits alone, but they want to cut them.
So cut the benefits and pay more.
Right.
And are the supermarket owners saying, hey, we've got to do this because here comes Walmart?
That's part of the reason. Like for the first few months leading up to the strike, we were bombarded with videotapes from our headquarters saying how bad Walmart would be, the competition, and a number of other things. But they left out what our CEO of Safeway has done to bring down the company.
So the company has its own internal issues. But let me ask you, Ted, after your years working there in the meat department at Vons, would you like to work in the meat department at a Walmart?
No.
Why not?
Definitely lower pay. I'm not sure how the benefits are, if there are any, but I know they're not as good as ours.
Mm-hmm. Diane, let me ask you the same question. You work at Ralph's. Would you like to work at Walmart?
No, I wouldn't.
And why not?
Lower wages, I would probably say work conditions. They just recently, Governor Gray Davis, that was one of the last things he signed into law, was the mandatory health care for Walmart workers. And it's just incredible the amount of hours and time in with the company that they're requiring these people to have to put in before they're eligible for insurance. And then if they want to add family members, I mean, you're talking about more time. I mean, you could be working for them for up to 3 years before you get any kind of health care.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you can't survive like that. These are families that have real issues. I mean, we have a girl who just found out 4 days ago her husband has leukemia. These are very real issues. I mean, you know, it's all about health care, and they don't want to pay into health care. You know, they pay their employees, you know, very low wages compared to us. And the cost of living, you know, here in California, it isn't, you know, it isn't low. I mean, there's a high cost of living out here.
But, you know, Diane, Walmart's incredibly popular. It's the world's biggest retailer. I'm sure you've got plenty of Walmarts in your area already. You must shop there yourself sometimes.
You know, we really don't where I'm at because I'm located right by the beaches. They're out towards Orange County.
Mm-hmm.
And, yes, I have shopped at them before. But the ones that we have out here don't have supermarkets in them. And the union asks that we don't support them, that we do boycott them just for the fact that they are not union. And they do not want to pay. their employees what they should actually be making. They do not want to give them any health and welfare benefits, and it's wrong. I mean, these people have families. You know, you need health and welfare for your families and yourself as we start to get older.
Got it. But, Ted, if Walmart and other, you know, big super bargain stores are setting the new bar for efficiency and for low prices, do you have a hope that Americans aren't eventually going to go there if they're selling the same groceries, more or less, at a significant discount from what your supermarket can offer? Is it inevitable that people are going to go and shop there and you're going to have to, or you or other workers like you, are going to have to take what they pay?
That's not necessarily true. It depends. Like where I work, Vons, we stress service. So a lot of our customers know us by name. They come for our service, and that's what we base our job on, is service. They send secret shoppers in to shop us to make sure we are doing service, and we get bonuses. If we get, say, 20 good shops in a row, we can miss one, and we get a bonus. And so that's how we compete.
On service.
On service.
But price is pretty powerful, too.
I mean, that is pretty powerful, too.
You must have seen that. So what are you thinking? You're 6 weeks into the strike, Diane. Do you think you're going to hang on to those wages and benefits that you've built up to after 20-some years at Ralph's?
You know, I'm really hoping that we do, because I don't believe that the grocery stores can compare us to a Walmart, because a Walmart is a whole different shopping experience. That would be like going into a Costco or a Sam's Club. People shop at certain stores for certain items. I mean, Walmart is basically, you know, real, real similar to a Target or a Kmart. So, I mean, they're completely different shopping experiences. I've started as a box person. I have 25 years in. My husband has 22. I've always had health care, and I'm not about to lose it now. I mean, we are all out here fighting for our families.
And if you went to $9 an hour and much lower health care with a larger input from yourself, what would that mean for your family, Diane?
We wouldn't be able to survive. There's just no way. There is no way that we could survive. I mean, I would have to leave the company and look elsewhere into management someplace else, because, you know, you can't feed a family on $9 an hour. I mean, it's just, you know, it's incredible. And you know, to pay the health care that they want us, I mean, they want a deductible, they want a copay, they want to cut us by 50%. They want us to pay up to 50% of the bill. They want to put caps on chemotherapy. They want to put caps on the surgeon. And, I mean, there's just so many issues regarding this that you couldn't survive on $9.
That's a different world to you. Diane DeBoer, Ted Lipke, we'll be watching closely, and thank you very much to both of you for joining us from L.A. tonight.
Thank you for having me.
We're talking tonight about the new Walmarting of America, about Walmart prices and Walmart wages. It's not just Walmart, but this is, in a way, maybe a kind of symbol of globalization, of what's happening with hyper-efficiency. It brings a lot of great bargains for American shoppers, but there may be another side to it. We're looking into that tonight, trying to figure it out. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined now from Berkeley, California, by Harley Shaken. He's professor of labor and the global economy at the University of California, Berkeley. Good evening and welcome, Harley Shaken.
Good evening. It's good to be here.
It's great to have you. Harley, help us sort this out. Many Americans have felt the benefit of shopping at Walmart and stores like Walmart to their family's budget. You can buy a lot for a little. Is there another side that's just becoming clear? Has it been clear for a while? Is Walmart the kind of representative of globalization, you know, zooming those low-cost products in but somehow bringing low wages with it? Why?
Walmart's giving us the best and the worst of globalization all at the same time. In a way, it's giving us 21st century methods and 19th century labor relations. The methods are very efficient operation, terrific logistics, economies of scale, but the 19th century labor relations is an unrelenting downward pressure on wages, an attempt to eliminate benefits, a very anti-union posture, and the net result is great prices, wonderful selection at times, but workers who can't afford to buy the very products they're selling often. The average wage of a Walmart clerk, the New York Times tells us, is about $8.50 an hour. That turns out to be $14,000 a year. That's about $1,000 lower than the U.S. government's figure for poverty wages for a family of four. So, in effect, what we're getting here is wages so low that full-time workers qualify for poverty status that they're supporting a family.
Harley, this is what caught our eye in this kind of odd situation where if you've got a decent job and you're shopping at those low prices at Walmart, it's great. But if somehow you tumble out of that job and end up working at Walmart, it's not so great. Is that inevitable, that 21st century methods and 19th century labor relations? Is that, are they somehow part and parcel of the same globalization dynamic or not? Could they be separated?
Oh, I think not only could they be separated, they really have to be separated. And a bit of history, in a way, is in order here. If we look at the periods in the 20th century when the U.S. economy grew most rapidly and when Americans felt best in terms of their economic health, those weren't the points when U.S. firms paid the lowest wages. They were the points when they were paying the highest wages, but they had productivity that was even higher. And it was this virtuous circle. High productivity, that is really efficient operations, very high wages, workers who earned a lot, so they became consumers who spent a lot, mm-hmm. which in turn gave us demand. That's what caused economic success in the last century. If we decouple those two, that is, if we simply have efficient firms at very low wages, ultimately the question is, who buys the product?
But why shouldn't there be a virtuous circle even in the Walmart era?
Well, it's a less virtuous circle because if you're earning $14,000 a year, you're not going to be buying much more than $14,000 a year worth of goods. And that, in fact, gives us lower demand because the pressure is so fierce on those who are working. And that's only part of the story. You mentioned globalization. Walmart has put such a pressure on its suppliers that many of them, even most of them in certain areas, have moved offshore to places like China where wages our rock bottom. Walmart imports $12 billion worth of goods a year from China. That's great when it comes to the cost, but when it comes to sustaining the wage that drives the economy, it leaves a bit to be desired.
Harley Shaken, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Charles Fishman. He joins us from Raleigh, North Carolina. He's a writer for Fast Company magazine. His most recent piece is The Walmart You Don't Know. It's in the December issue. Good evening and welcome, Charles Fishman.
Good evening. Thank you.
Charles, you've written that Walmart is a kind of a magnifying power on the Darwinian forces already at work in modern global capitalism. What do you mean by that?
Well, as the professor said, Walmart's sort of doing the right thing all the time, relentless efficiency across its labor relations, across its logistics. And the story I wrote is about its relationships with its suppliers. Walmart insists on the lowest possible price all the time. But Walmart is so big that the consequence of that is sometimes very anti-capitalistic. The opening anecdote we have in the story is about Walmart insisting on Vlasic pickles providing a gallon of kosher dills for $2.97.
A gallon for $2.97, that's a big jar for $2.97.
It's basically a year's supply of pickles for an American family for less than $3.
And the result for Vlasic was the happy days are here again or not?
No, the result for Vlasic was terrible. It chewed up their profit margins. It completely distorted their pickle business.
So why'd they go along with it?
But hang on one second. The results... The $2.97 gallon of pickles was not the result of a glut of pickles that needed to be cleared by lowering the price.
Mm-hmm.
It was not the result, as in the world of cell phones, of a vicious pickle producer price war to get people to buy pickles and gain market share.
Okay.
The price had nothing to do with the market. The price was set by Walmart. That's not capitalism. That's, you know, a form of muscle, it's not legal price fixing, but it's price fixing.
But why should they be able to get away with that in the labor market? They're not nearly as dominant in the labor market as they are in retailing generally.
Well, I'll step in, but the professor may know more. The markets that they operate in, many of the markets that they operate in, there are not, in fact, good job opportunities. I recently wrote a story about a town in Oklahoma. The largest employer there is the federal government, the nation's only bomb factory. The second largest employer is Walmart for 100 miles around.
So if you can make $9 an hour there, you may take it and be glad for it.
And, you know, you talk about how $9 an hour barely gets you to poverty wages in the United States. It's also, whatever, 40%, 50%, 60% over the minimum wage. So a $9 an hour job in some places is a real good job because you're not getting paid $6 an hour.
Charles Fishman, Harley Shaken, please stand by. We're talking tonight about the new Walmarting of America, about Walmart prices and Walmart wages. You can join the conversation. Can America have Walmart prices and middle-class wages? Americans like to shop at Walmart. Would you like to work there? And can we ultimately have $9 blue jeans and $19 an hour jobs? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the new Walmarting of America, about Walmart prices and Walmart wages, about Walmart as the cutting edge of globalization in America. And that edge cuts, it seems, two ways. You can join the conversation tonight. Can America have Walmart prices and middle-class wages? Are Americans bargain shopping themselves out of decent jobs? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by Professor Harley Shaken. He's a professor of labor and global economy at the University of California, Berkeley. He joins us from Berkeley, California. From Raleigh, North Carolina, by Charles Fishman, a writer for Fast Company magazine. His piece in the December issue is The Walmart You Don't Know. And now from Chicago, Alan Sanderson, a professor and economist at the University of Chicago. Good evening and welcome, Alan Sanderson.
Good evening.
Professor Sanderson, help us out here. We really don't want to beat up on Walmart in many ways. They're absolutely the exemplar of how to do business efficiently. And yet we look at this and it's confusing. Like, take the Southern California example. If all those supermarket workers are suddenly making half what they made before, they've got better prices, but even those may be a stretch for them. Are poorer wages inevitably part and parcel of what Walmart represents or not?
Well, wages in a labor market tend to be, you know, determined by supply and demand, what somebody's productivity is, what the substitutes are, technological change can affect that, what fraction of the population is willing and able to work, the education level, and things like that. The fact that somebody may, with his or her skills and opportunities, be able to make enough to live on, I think is a different matter, not something you want to beat up on Walmart about. I think they ought to pay, you know, whatever wind up being free market type wages. If that ends up not being enough, the society thinks that that's insufficient to live on, then we ought to handle that through a generalized redistribution through taxes and transfers, not by forcing Walmart or McDonald's or somebody else to pay wages that are higher than somebody's productivity.
Okay, we know University of Chicago is all about the free market, and we're all for it. We love to see it work. But why do you think... Why do you think it's not exactly working here in terms of the virtuous circle that Harley Shaken was describing before? Have we somehow broken that circle? And does globalization somehow figure into that? Does Walmart, Charlie Fishman describes it as a giant pipeline bringing in super low-cost goods, does that somehow inevitably lead to lower-paying jobs? Why should it?
Well, I guess I would disagree some with Harley and his interpretation, who were sort of micro out to macro. He said, you know, at $8.50 an hour, that's $14,000, and that's less than the poverty standard for a family of four, which is true. But the issue is $8.50 an hour is above the poverty standard for one person. And so what one wants to know is, this often gets sort of sleight of hand and moving from wages for one person versus family of four.
Except any way you cut it, it isn't great. We're talking with these two workers in California before who were making, you know, maybe $19 an hour. That's an awful lot better situation.
Well, $19 an hour is approximately the average going wage rate in the United States. So these are two people who are striking for their jobs because they want more than $19 an hour. I mean, basically what they want is the employer to pay for benefits and pensions, and the employer wants them to pay it, and that's what the squabble is about.
And they don't want to end up working at Walmart.
Well, you know, that's an option. I mean, they may well, in spite of what was said, shop at Walmart or stores that are like that. You know, do Ted and Diane pump their own gas, for example, or do they use full service?
Mm-hmm.
Have they ever bought anything on the web? You know, do Diane and Ted have spouses who work? You know, those are other kind of questions. The more macro issue of globalization is that, yeah, globalization does bite into this in the sense that for the last 20 years, wages of unskilled workers have been falling, and wages of skilled workers have been rising. And so you get this inequality between skilled and unskilled. And it's not just, it's certainly not a Walmart issue, and it's not just a U.S. issue.
Mm-hmm.
The widening inequality of wages is true worldwide. And in part, it's a technological issue. The rate of technological change has been enormous. A lot of people find them on the downside, you know, where a 12-year-old boy or 12-year-old girl may be much better than a 50-year-old male at lots of these jobs. And people, unfortunately, are finding themselves on, you know, the wrong side of the street.
Harley Shaken, how about it? Do we just have maybe Walmart's representing a new reality here? If you don't have skills that will hold you above, you know, a stocking job or a grocery store job, you're just going to have to live with that $9 an hour wage.
No, I think there's something else that's going on here. I agree with much of what Alan said about how wages are determined in terms of economic techs. But in the real world, there's something else that figures into this, and here it's monopoly power. Walmart is a very powerful company without the traditional checks and balances that other firms have had, principally unions, for example. So Walmart has been very, very anti-union in terms of its operations, and as a result, given its enormous power, 1.4 million workers worldwide, the huge share of retail sales that it has, it's in effect been able to set wages. And the net result of that is people who are desperate have little choices. The efficiency of Walmart, of course, is exemplary. And there are many things that Walmart has done as a firm that are worth emulating. But in the area of labor relations and ultimately in the area of wages, what Walmart is doing may be good for Walmart today, but very bad for the U.S. economy tomorrow, and certainly bad for Walmart workers even today, given the fact that there is a disconnect in many ways between the level of their productivity and the kind of wages they receive, principally because the workers have very few other options.
Harley Shaken, Alan Sanderson, Charles Fishman, stand by. I want to invite our callers in. Mike's calling from Cuba City, Wisconsin. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Good to have you.
Good timing of it, because 1 week ago I read that article in Fast Company, and I've decided to boycott Walmart. I mean, I'm only one consumer. It's my family and I, but I'm boycotting them. I think that they're not mega efficiency. I think that they're mega bullying, and they'll tell a supplier, we won't buy from you unless you cut your rates and the cost of your goods, and the only way they can do that is cut their wages.
But Mike, as a consumer, isn't Walmart fighting for you?
No, they're fighting for themselves, their own stock price.
But they're bringing you low prices. They're bringing you a gallon of Vlasic pickles for $2.97, a year's worth.
And at the same time, they're cutting everybody's standard of living in half. You know, I don't want to live in the United States like that. You know, the United States has grown very accustomed to a certain standard of living. Walmart is cutting that in half, not only because of Walmart's employees, but also everybody that Walmart buys from.
Yeah, it's quite a story. We've got the picture. Mike, thanks very much for your call. Charles Fishman.
Can I interject one thing here?
Is this Alan?
This is Alan.
Yes, please, Alan Sanderson.
Yeah. I mean, Harley and I are going to agree on lots of things, and then we're going to disagree on some things. I just don't see Walmart, you know, this notion that Walmart has monopoly power. They're a very small fish in this kind of pond.
Walmart, you're referring to the labor pond.
The labor pond. Or retail sales are even a smaller fish.
Walmart's a small fish in the retail pond?
Yeah,
they're the
absolutely.
Biggest retailer in the world.
Yeah, but what percent of world sales do they really account for? I mean, it's trivial, okay?
In terms of the
labor market, they're number one in terms of employment size in the U.S., but they employ less than 1% of the U.S. labor force. To say that Walmart employees don't have options, they can't go anywhere else, is just, I think that's empirically, you know, just not justifiable, or that Walmart sets wages.
Is that Charles Fishman?
Can I jump in on a couple of those points? The first thing is they actually represent 8% of U.S. retail sales, which may seem small, except when you start ticking off categories, the number one seller of eyeglasses, the number one seller of deodorant, the number one seller of toothpaste in the country. So you can say, well, they represent a small piece, yes, but they have enormous market power.
And what about in particular markets, Charles Fishman?
And in many of the labor markets in which they operate, Walmart's whole model is built on, at least to begin with, opening stores in rural areas where they actually, in some ways, they raised the availability of goods. They raised the available standard of living in the sense of what you could buy easily. But those people did not have, in fact, huge labor mobility. You can look at it in a sort of a textbook or equation sense and say, sure, there's plenty of other places to work in the big picture, but many people don't want to move to Dallas or to Louisville. They want to stay where they are.
And so what were those people doing before Walmart moved into the rural area? Where were they working?
Well, let me jump in on this.
Many of them
were entering the labor market. Others were in firms that have gone offshore, so they're looking for jobs. We have relatively high unemployment right now, and in many of the areas that Walmart operates, there is a willing workforce because there are so few other options. In effect, when this economy has worked best in the past, we've had a sense of checks and balances in the labor market. We've had very effective employers, but we've also had unions that were able to put wages and benefits on the front burner. As a result of that, we've all benefited as a society because productivity rose very rapidly, but also the living standards of people rose along with it. With Walmart, we have the checks, but none of the balances.
See, and I just disagree with that. There have never been more checks and balances. Spatial monopolies, as communications gets better, transportation costs drop, have dropped. And the sort of the union song is just not true. There are ways in which unions increase productivity. There are ways in which unions decrease productivity. But to say over the last 20 years or 30 years, when union power has been, you know, relatively unimportant, we've had high rates of economic growth for those who are skilled. We've had very good wage rates. I just don't think it washes.
Charles Fishman, I want to carve out a minute here for you just to describe for our listeners, if you would, who have not read your piece, and it's really eye-opening, the kind of relations Walmart has with some of the manufacturers that deal with it. It seems to me to be telling in some way. Give a sense of the dynamic there beyond the Vlasic story. Give us some more.
Well, in some ways, the Vlasic story is worth teasing out one notch further. Vlasic sold 30% of its pickles to Walmart. That meant 70% of its pickles were sold elsewhere, but it also meant that if it lost Vlasic's business, you know, the per share earnings dropped for the quarter dramatically, the sales dropped dramatically, the CEO's in trouble, the board of directors is unhappy, the stock price plummets.
So even though they were losing money on every gallon of pickles sold, they really couldn't walk away from it. Tell us about the story of Master Brands, Master Lock in Milwaukee.
Right, and this is so that Master Lock in Milwaukee was a union shop and is still a union shop for almost 100 years. They made locks in Milwaukee. And they simply faced price pressure from overseas producer, Asian. Literally, the CEO of Master Brands went to Bentonville, and
Walmart headquarters.
Right, which is where Walmart is headquartered.
In Arkansas.
And the buyer would put a lock from Asia on the table and say, I can sell this lock for $6, and you want me to sell your lock for $11. Why? They do the same thing.
And what about Huffy Bicycles?
The Huffy story is kind of remarkable. The man who was president of Huffy in the 80s talked to us, and he at one point he had made a commitment to supply a particularly low priced bike to Walmart for one season, along with a bunch of other bikes, and the low priced bike took off, and he couldn't supply all of his customers with all of the bikes and all of the price ranges that they needed. He supplied Walmart with the low priced bike and licensed out his most profitable bikes to his competitors to keep Toys R Us and other retailers in bikes just to keep Walmart happy with the low-priced bike. And he said to me, I didn't even think about it. I didn't have to ask them what they wanted me to do or what I should do. They wanted as many of the low-priced bike as they could sell. So Walmart ends up in a position of enormous power. Dial Soap, a name everybody hearing this broadcast can recognize.
Sure.
Dial Soap does 29% of their business a year with Walmart. Their next 9 customers don't equal Walmart's business in size. If they anger Walmart and they lose Walmart's business, and there's a story in this story about a bra company that angered Walmart and lost their business, Dial Soap's next 9 largest customers would all have to double their business just to get Dial Soap back to even.
And one of the points you make is that Walmart is a kind of this giant pipeline. If they don't like what you're charging, they can open it to a foreign manufacturer and bring it in at a pace more rapid than in the past.
It's not that they can. It's that they inevitably do. There's an umbrella maker in the story who had costs go up. He was a domestic umbrella maker. He said, I need a 10% price increase. They said, we were expecting year over year a 10% price decrease. Go figure it out again. And he came back and said, I can live with a 4% price increase or a 3% price increase. They said, forget it. We're going offshore. We'll get your umbrellas for what we wanted.
And instantly there's national distribution for all those umbrellas. Right. Roger's calling from Hingham, Massachusetts. Hi, Roger. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks a lot for taking my call,
sure.
and I appreciate the great debate you've got going on. I have a comment that I'd like to, or a question that I'd like to ask for the guests and get their responses, and I'm sure they may have different perspectives, but I'd love to hear them. To what extent do you think that the globalization and the Walmartization of the United States economy, if I can use that as a verb, is reflective of a changing value by our society of the various stakeholder groups that make up a company? And I mean, are we shifting too far towards the capital and away from the other stakeholders, the workers in particular, and perhaps even the customers? And the best way I can sort of articulate the point is, earlier your question, Tom, was where did these people used to work? And I think the answer is they used to work on Main Street, at the mom-and-pop hardware store, at the mom-and-pop bike shop. And through more efficient distribution, Walmart has sort of very strategically placed themselves in sort of rural markets and destroyed Main Streets all over America.
But a lot of shoppers have benefited from that in many ways.
And so the question is, it's like if you put too much food out for your dog, he'll eat himself to death.
Let us pick that up, and I'm sure we'll have many views on it. Alan Sanderson, to you first. A shift in values, a shift in stakeholder priority?
No, I don't think so, either on the part of workers or employers, or stockholders, any of those. I don't see value or shoppers, for that matter. I don't see values changing as much as sort of the incentive structure and the cost. I mean, it's just a lot easier to ship things now, a lot cheaper to ship things longer distances, and we tend to buy things, made across the world. The increased percent of international trade has gone up enormously in the last three decades, in part just driven by those kind of technical considerations.
Let me jump in here. I disagree with that because I think there's a profound social shift that's going on right here. When Walmart moves a supplier from Peoria to Beijing, it isn't simply a geographical shift. It's a profound shift in the social structure. What Walmart then is importing is not simply a low-cost part or commodity to sell. It's importing the low-wage structure and the lack of labor rights that exists there.
This labor rights and union stuff, you just got to find another story.
Story for you right now. Let's see what an alternative might look like. Let's go back to January 5th, 1914. A very powerful company, as cost-conscious, if not more so, than Walmart, was dominating the most important manufacturing industry in the country, automobiles. That was the Ford Motor Company. Mm. January 5th, Henry Ford makes an announcement. He says, we have increased our productivity dramatically. We're going to double the average wage of our workers to $5 a day. Editorial writers decried it. His competitors said this was lunacy. What then happened? Henry Ford doubled the wage, continued to increase productivity, lowered the price of the car, and somehow miraculously increased the profitability of the Ford Motor Company in the next year by 20%.
There's a history lesson to dwell on. Does it still work? Harley Shaken, Alan Sanderson, Charles Fishman, stand by. We're talking tonight about the new Walmarting of America, Walmart prices, and Walmart wages. You can join the conversation. Does your hunt for a bargain mesh with the workers' hunt for a decent paying job? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Walmart, globalization, and the hidden cost of everyday low prices. You can join the conversation. How do we digest globalization without crushing a class of workers' wages? Is it Walmart's fault that it's opening the door to hyper-efficiency and global low prices? Can America have Walmart prices and middle-class wages? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight from Chicago by Alan Sanderson, an economist at the University of Chicago, by Harley Shaken in Berkeley, California, professor of labor and global economy at the University of California, Berkeley, and from Raleigh, North Carolina, by Charles Fishman, a writer for Fast Company magazine, right now by Leo, calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Leo. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you today?
Great, thanks.
I just... think this discussion is kind of strange. The reason that Vlasic sold their pickles at such a low price that they didn't make any profit is because they were suckers and they didn't say no. I mean, basically, if you're in business, you're in business to make a profit. It's really not about the number of units sold. No matter how much, you know, if you sell 100% of your product at no profit at all, you're broke. I don't know. I mean,
what about the workers' perspective here, Leo? What about you when you go shopping? Does it matter to you if Walmart workers make $9 or $19 an hour, or are you just shopping for the low price?
I'm always shopping for the low price. If it's the same product in two different stores and one has the lower price, I'm going for the low price every single time because I have my family to worry about, not the workers' family. And truthfully, I have told employers who have asked me to go to work, no. I've said, no, you don't offer enough money, I'll go work elsewhere. And everybody has that opportunity. And
Vlasic has it too. We've got it. Leo, thanks very much for your call. Charles Fishman, first to you on the Vlasic point. They're suckers, Leo says.
Let me make a point that sort of Leo's comment gets at. The problem, and one of the problems with Professor Sanderson's argument is, it's not a level playing field. Almost half the clothes that Walmart sells are made in China, but they aren't made with the same labor and safety regulations that exist in the United States. They certainly aren't made.
Don't you have another story, Charles?
Can I finish my point?
Alan Sanderson, I'll come to you in just a moment. Charles Fishman first, please.
They aren't made with the same clean air and clean water regulations, and all that infrastructure costs money. One of the clothing manufacturers I talked to said specifically that often clothes produced in Asia are so inexpensive that if American workers worked for free, they still wouldn't be competitive with
Asia. Okay, but there's about comparative advantage and all that. Let's put that aside for a moment. What about the Vlasic story? Our caller Leo says if they sell for below cost, they're just fools.
He's right. Vlasic made a strategic mistake in agreeing to the 297 gallon in the first place. The flaw in Leo's comment was, if Vlasic says no, they lose 30% of their business in a flash. Walmart said very clearly, if you don't give us this product, we'll get it from your competitors. We'll stop stocking the rest of your pickles because we'll make room for their pickles.
So that's market power. Now, Alan Sanderson, to you, Leo says, look, I'm going to shop for the lowest price. I'd be a fool to do otherwise. That is supposed to work. If everybody shops for the lowest price, it encourages efficiency and productivity. Is it working right now?
Yeah, I don't understand why it's not. Again, competition, the U.S. economy has gotten much more competitive over time. I mean, certainly Charles' point, you know, the sort of Henry Ford story, I always hear this in various incarnations, which says, geez, if an employer would just double wages, its productivity would go up, he would make more money. Well, you know, employers are not stupid. So why wouldn't, you know, what Charles ought to do is go into consulting for firms, say, if, you know, here's the deal, you double your wages, you double your productivity.
But let me ask you, what about the globalization factor? Does it change the old formula at all? Are we in some kind of adjustment period here or not?
Well, as I said before, I think we are in an adjustment period because we've had the last 20 years that's had enormous amounts of technological change at the same time this increasing globalization. And some people get caught on the wrong side of that envelope. It is a transition.
But we're always going to have to buy groceries somewhere. And if people selling us those groceries used to make $19 an hour and somehow it all worked out, now they're making $9. Someone's got to fill those jobs.
Well, that's the assumption. I mean, we're starting 19 and 9. It's not clear. I mean, the Diane and Ted, as you said at the outset of the show, were probably making $20 an hour. That, you know, that's for an individual. That's above the average wage in the United States.
But, Professor, the number one seller of groceries in America from a standing start 5 years ago, Walmart, average wages at Walmart are not $19 an hour.
Well,
and they're putting grocery chains out of business. Now, you can say they're out-competing them.
The one thing that we know indisputably is that the average wage of clerks at Walmart is $8.50 an hour. And I misspoke before. Mm-hmm. That doesn't lead to $1,000 below the poverty wage for a family of four. It's the poverty wage for a family of three. So we have a decoupling between an economic success story that's genuinely very impressive and what workers are making. And part of that has to do with globalization, that is low-cost sourcing abroad. And part of that has to do with Walmart's wage and industrial relations policies here. Clearly, they're an effective company. Clearly, workers are making below poverty wages in many cases. The question then is, how do we bring these two together? Because if we don't, then I think the success of Walmart as a firm benefits consumers in the short run, but undermines this economy and ultimately this society.
Alan Sanderson said earlier, Harley Shaken, that what you do in that case is adjust tax policy so that you redirect the flow of wealth to support those people making low wages. What about that as a solution?
That as a solution is illusory. It simply isn't going to happen. Ultimately, we need balances in our labor markets. That's why we have labor laws initially that gave workers certain rights in the workplace. In practice, many of those laws are either flouted or ignored today.
Let me get another call here. Tom is calling from South Beloit, Illinois. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hello. This is a comment that your guest can respond to.
Okay.
It's like a variation on the golden rule. If you're not willing to pay your neighbor a fair wage or a fair price for his product, not only are you losing a customer, but you're destroying your community, and ultimately you're destroying the country.
But, Tom, let me ask you something. We saw this 25 years ago with Japanese cars. They came in cheaper. People bought them and buy them in huge numbers because they were cheap and good. Isn't it inevitable that people will go for that lower-cost item, that lower-priced item?
You still have to look at the long-term effect, and you still have to look at what's going to happen down the line. For starters, are your kids going to have a job?
We got it, Tom. Thanks very much for your call. Alan Sanderson, what about it? Where do we end up here? Someone's going to be working in these retail stores. If they're just paying less, are you still saying that means a tax policy has to change?
Well, if we want people to have access to more than, say, $14,000 a year, then, yeah, let's handle that as a public debate and decide how much money we want those people to have.
But Harley Shaken says that will never happen as a political reality.
Well, no, it's already happening. Earned income tax credit is a small step in that direction.
That's true.
A number of you have sort of said, gee, what we want, I mean, you start off the session, I think, this after the break with let's have a level playing field. It's not clear to me. If I say it's not clear to me it's a level playing field, most of you on the call would say, well, it's absolutely not. The employers have all the advantages. It's not clear to me that employers have an advantage. Labor law protects workers. It allows them to collude in ways that would be illegal if firms colluded. It's just not clear when you've got a union representing grocery workers in the Los Angeles areas, they can collude and essentially are then a monopoly. Grocery stores cannot do the same thing.
What those workers are doing in Los Angeles is they're right under the law. This country respects collective bargaining.
I don't disagree. I'm just saying that it's an unequal playing field in the direction you suggest it is.
Charles Fishman, I want to ask you one question here. I see Walmart's supposed to open 200 more superstores, super centers a year selling groceries. Does this mean we're going to have a kind of revolution like we did when the A&P came in, that supermarkets are going to be gone? We'll all be shopping at Walmart supermarket groceries.
Well, one thing that's sort of been put aside is what the Walmart experience itself is. It's not just a question of whether you want the rock bottom price. You have to be willing to take the Walmart shopping experience. I don't think that, in fact, the supercenters are going to put all the big grocery store chains out of business, only because anybody who's ever, I don't know whether the two economists have, I've shopped in Walmarts, hundreds of times. The big combined Walmart and Walmart grocery stores are very difficult to navigate.
There's a limit to that. And Harley Shaken, we just got 20 seconds left. Alan Sanderson's solution, very simply, is adjust the tax structure. What's your solution?
We have a level playing field, except we have a bulldozer on the playing field. We need checks and balances. Walmart does a very good job in some ways. We need workers to have rights, to have a countervailing force in the workplace so wages can go up with competitive success.
Well, we haven't solved this one tonight, but I hope we've opened the discussion up a little bit. Harley Shaken at Berkeley, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
And Alan Sanderson at the University of Chicago, thank you very much for being with us.
Certainly welcome, Tom.
And Charles Fishman, terrific piece in Fast Company. A really, really riveting, eye-opening reading. Thanks very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you. It's on the web free. No charge.
Okay.
Good night.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, a reading from National Book Award finalist Edward P. Jones. This is On Point. Tonight, winners of the National Book Award will be announced in New York. Among the nominees is Edward P. Jones. His first novel, The Known World, is based on the little-known fact that before the Civil War, some freed black Americans owned slaves. The Known World tells the fictional story of black slave owner Henry Townsend. Earlier today, we caught up with Edward P. Jones. He shared his thoughts on blacks owning slaves and read a passage from The Known World.
Slavery was propped up first by the law and, of course, by what all those people who supported slavery had read in the Bible, that God sanctioned slavery, and so that therefore it must be all right. Many of the black slave owners in the book, and of course I'm dealing almost exclusively with them, parrot the line that white people would parrot, that the law says it's fine to own slaves, and therefore I will. God in the Bible says it's fine to own slaves, and therefore I will. Henry Townsend starts out saying that he's going to be a better slave owner than any white man had ever been, which is something, of course, that's impossible. He forgets that the whole problem is slavery itself. And in the end, of course, he's doomed because of that. The problem isn't any sort of benevolence on some man's part. It's the whole system of slavery, the whole system of owning one human being. So Henry Townsend, in the end, isn't any better or worse than any white slave owner, I think. This is the morning after Henry Townsend has died. Moses, his black overseer, has been told to go and tell all the slaves that the master is dead. This is Moses setting out to do that job. Moses went back and forth across the lane and told all of the cabins save one were occupied. A man, Peter, had died in that one, and his widow, May, had abandoned it to give Peter's spirit time and space to prepare to go home. Before Moses had reached the last cabin on this side of the lane, the one Alice, whom he called the Night Walker, shared with Delphi and her daughter Cassandra, the slaves were filling the lane. A few women had cried, remembering the way Henry smiled, or how he would join them in singing, or thinking that the death of anyone, good or bad, master or not, cut down one more tree in the life forest that shielded them from their own death. But most said or did nothing. Their world had changed, but they could not yet understand how. A black man had owned them, a strange thing for many in that world, and now that he was dead, maybe a white man would buy them, which was not as strange. No matter what, though, the sun would come up on them tomorrow, followed by the moon, and dogs would chase their own tails, and the sky would remain just out of reach. "I didn't sleep well," one man across the lane from Elias said to his next-door neighbor. "Well, I know I sure did," the neighbor said. "I slept like they were paying me to. Slept enough for three white women without a care in the world." "Well," the first man said, "sounds like you got a hold of some of my sleep. Better give it back. Better give it back for you wear out my sleep using it. Give it back." "Oh, I will," the neighbor said, laughing, inspecting loose threads on his overalls. "I sure will, soon as I'm finished. Meantime, I'm going to use it again tonight. Come for it in the morning." They both laughed. It was often the case that Alice, the night walker, would be standing just inside her door when Moses opened it each morning, dressed and ready to work, as if she had been standing at the door waiting for him all night. She was waiting now, and she was smiling, the same smile she had for everything, from the death of a neighbor's baby to the four oranges Henry and Caldonia gave each slave on Christmas morning. "Baby dead, baby dead, baby dead," she would chant. "Christmas oranges, Christmas oranges, Christmas oranges, in the morning."
Edward P. Jones is author of The Known World and a finalist for the National Book Award, being awarded a half hour from now in New York. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Amata, Julie Jupp, Chris O'Connor, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog. With help from Sarah Cook, our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.